Welcome to Global Investment Voice, where we explore investment migration issues and opportunities from around the world. With a special focus on the U.S. EB-5 Immigrant Investor Program, we'll also cover citizenship and residency by investment programs from around the globe. If you're an investor, fund manager, developer, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of these global investment migration programs, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host attorneys, Mona Shaw and Rebecca Singh, as well as other investment migration leaders from around the world. So let's get into Global Investment Voice. Mona, I know for over 8 years we've been covering EB-5 in quite some depth, but today is a different topic. We're going to be talking about the E-2 visa, right?
We are, and we're not.
Oh, okay.
let me explain. We do have a lot of podcasts actually relating to the E-2 visa because it is a very popular visa that folk really want to hear about. But most of them are really relating to, you know, the ins and outs of the legal ramparts. And we do get complaints that for many listeners who want to understand E-2, it really goes over their head. So we're doing something a little different today.
Yeah, Mona, E-2 is a visa, but it's really about the people. And I think because of that, we're going to have someone on today that has, intimate knowledge and experience, and certainly firsthand experience on the E-2 visa itself.
Right. So we thought that it would be a good idea to actually map the journey of a candidate who successfully went through the E-2 visa to look at the hurdles and just to ask the kind of questions that I think a lot of our listeners really want to hear. As you know, Mark, to be eligible for an E-2 visa, which is an investment visa, you have to be a citizen, not born, but a citizen of certain countries, certain treaty countries. Today, our guest is actually from Canada, which is definitely a treaty country.
That's right. Today on the show, we have Greg Allen. Greg established Allen House Metals and has developed the company into a full-service precious metals firm. In conjunction with Dillon Gage, they're an authorized purchaser for the United States Mint and many other government mints around the world. They specialize in the purchase, sale, and storage of physical gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Mark and Mona. I'm excited to be here.
Greg, are you speaking to us from Canada or from the good old USA?
Right now, I am in the good old USA. I'm speaking to you guys from West Palm Beach, Florida.
Oh, I'm jealous. It's so cold here right now in New York.
Yeah. Listen, that's one bonus you'll never hear me complain about. The weather in Florida is certainly better than Toronto, where I'm from originally, which is probably pretty similar to New York. So right now, we're in the high 80s and sunny.
Damn. Okay, so let me ask you. What capacity or what is your legal status currently in the United States?
Currently, I'm on an E-2 visa. We achieved the most recent E-2 we achieved in March. So fresh E-2. They give you the five-year visa in your paper, but the I-94 stamped for 2 years at a time, basically.
All right. So E-2 visa from Canada. Let's go through your journey, Greg. Why, first of all, did you want to come to the United States?
I think a big thing is not just for me, but also my family. We had visited a family in Florida before that were on a TN visa. While we were visiting them, we just noticed the lifestyle was fantastic in terms of the weather and everyone always being outside. But I think then when we started to think more
towards... that's Florida. That's not New York right now.
Yeah. But I think when we get into it, we actually talk about the business side of things. When we were looking at state taxes, federal taxes, when we were looking at the regulations regarding our business, the precious metals business specifically, it was a lot more favorable towards business owners, and it made it easier to do business, so to speak, than Canada.
Well, the U.S. is easier to do business on many fronts. But let me ask you, yes, you are probably going to pay a little less tax in America than you would in Canada. But you're also going to pay for things like private healthcare, and you would be getting healthcare for free in Canada. And there are other social benefits to being in Canada.
Yeah, well, that's a really good point. But I think like when I look at that question, I really approach it on on two fronts. And so when we talk about healthcare, one thing a lot of people don't realize about healthcare in Canada and being free is the wait times. Back in my hockey career, there were knee surgeries I needed that if I had to wait in line with the public in Canada, I legitimately, the ligaments in my knee would have died off by the time I got that surgery, right?
Oh, gosh.
And I think from a practical point of view, not just, you know, aside from the wait time, when we look at cost, most people that are financially able to qualify for an E2, right, because it's investment-based, these are people that are in higher tax brackets, right? We're talking people that are making six figures a year. And in Canada as a basis, your healthcare is about 33% of the taxes that you pay. And so if you think of it this way, you're paying $30,000+ towards healthcare per year if you're making over $200,000 a year. I know for my wife and I, for instance, in Florida, because this is something we just went through recently, to get equivalent level of care and coverage, it's costing us less than a third of that. I mean, we're both younger people. I'm in my late 20s. My wife's in her early 30s. But we're paying less than $1,000 a month for the both of us Aetna.
Oh, gosh. I'm sure there'll be a lot of politicians who will be loving that you're saying this. But don't say too much, because I believe our healthcare still needs a lot of work. But, yeah.
And I agree with you. Nothing's perfect, right? And for people that can't afford healthcare in terms of insurance, free healthcare in Canada is great. My only point when people bring that up to me is I think, you know, it's not as simple or cut and dry as you would think.
Interesting. Well, I have to admit that I've heard very similar stories from the UK and even my close family and friends. They've had to do private surgeries rather than wait for the national health. But yep. Let me ask you, E2 is not a permanent visa. It's a non-immigrant temporary visa related to a business. Why did you choose the E2?
Well, when I was looking at my situation, we tried to establish what's the best visa for myself, for my family, that we can come down on as soon as possible. It doesn't mean that we can't work towards, for instance, something like an EB-5. But we made the decision we want to move to Florida. We want to open a business in Florida. The E-2 was the quickest path to that. The other thing that we factored in is, while the visa itself is for 5 years, it's something that can be renewed. Right.
That's right. That's right. We actually have a client who's been on the E2 for more than 25 years, and she really doesn't want to be a citizen. She's quite happy on the E2, but it doesn't work for everyone. If you have children who are over 21, then they fall off the E2. But how difficult was it for you to discover what the right visa is? Because not everybody really understands how basically a person's business and everything runs and what really is the most appropriate visa for them.
To be honest, I mean, I think it's something that for us was, I wouldn't say nerve-wracking, but it was an intensive process, right? Because it's the first time where you're really like, oh, I'm an immigrant here, right? You never think of Canada and the U.S. as being different. And so for us, I mean, really discovering the E2 wasn't a long process. It probably took us about a week or two to discover that visa itself, but putting the package together and papering it correctly to where we could achieve that E2 is something of a longer feat, right?
Because it is a business at the end of the day, and not that many attorneys or lawyers really understand what exactly is required. Was it difficult for you to find the right representation, or did you find that you had to do a lot of work yourself?
Yeah, I found it's a very good question. Originally, I wanted to use an attorney that was used by family for simpler visas like TN, right?
Right.
And what I found was I just didn't find that their expertise was sufficient for an E2 because the E2 has a lot more that goes into it than a TN. I ended up finding my second try, found a great attorney that I used in Palm Beach Gardens. But for me, I ultimately found with the E2, that it starts and ends with you in the sense that your attorneys can only do with what you give them, right? And so you need to be very clear on what you provide them with. You need to be clear as well on what the requirements are to make sure you're putting the best package forward possible.
Wow, you're a dream client, Greg. The fact that you understand that, I really appreciate it. But let me ask you, you know, you are coming into a new country. I know you're saying that, you know, you think of Canada and America as very similar. And yes, in many ways they are, except that you have the queen, or sorry, the king, and you have better chocolate than they have in the US.
That's, you know, it's funny you say that, because I have family in the UK as well, over in Oxford. And that's one debate in my family that's always going. I know whenever they come over to visit, we're always begging them to bring Cadbury chocolate.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, just getting back to my thought, it is really still a different country. You do have to start from scratch. You don't have any credit history. You don't have any banking. You really don't know how to get started on a business. What were the hurdles that you faced, and what advice would you give for people who are thinking of starting their own business in a new country where they don't have any experience?
That, I think, is the most important thing when you're considering the E2. One of the biggest hurdles, I would say, or just misconceptions, is credit. Because not only do you not have credit, but the credit reporting system and the way that you build credit is fundamentally different in the United States and in Canada, right?
Right.
So obviously you need to have at least some sort of idea or plan for the business. My first moves when I knew that I was going to be opening up Allen House Metals, the precious metals dealer, was A, you have to have that business incorporated. B, you open up bank accounts for the business. And especially when we're talking E2, it's investment based. So you need to make that investment into your business as clear as possible. And what I mean when I say that, and I know you understand this, Mona, is that when you're making that investment, the clearer you can make the path of investment, the easier it is to prove to the consular officer when you have that interview that your investment is not, in fact, marginal, and that the investment was actually made and contributed to the business.
Well, when I ask you about marginal, what do you understand about marginal investment?
Well, to me, in terms of marginal, and obviously there's gray area in this, but in my head, that is a significant contribution to the business, right? And this changes as you have a more valuable business and you're doing more volume. But the way to me I understand it is you need to have enough capital invested so that you can feasibly run that business should it take you a more significant portion of time to grow revenue that is required for the business to run on its own, so to speak.
Yeah, that's so important, Greg, because we face people a lot of times who want to just open up an E2 with say, 50,000, and the business really requires 500,000 or 400,000. So you're absolutely correct.
Yeah, it's a good point about marginality, because USCIS wants to see that you, the E2 investor, are putting enough money in to operate that business. And if it's enough, for example, I know you not only purchase and sell precious metals, but you also store them. Did you have to provide documentation on how you plan to store them and then pay for that storage?
Yeah, good question, Mark.
Yeah, and that's a really good question. So we did. One of the things we're lucky with, and when it comes to the businesses, I found a team of service providers that would allow me to run this business with less capital than would be required if I provided all the services personally.
Ah, very good point.
What I mean by that is we talk about precious metals businesses, typically very capital intensive, right? If you think if you want to be competitive, you have to have millions of dollars just in product that's stored. So we have a company that we have a dealer contract with that's called Dillon Gage in Dallas, Texas. And they are an authorized purchaser for the United States Mint, as well as the Canadian Mint and many other government mints around the world. And so what that allows us to do is not only can we drop ship from stock that's held by them, and they have at times literally billions in stock, they provide secured storage facilities in Dallas, Delaware, and Toronto for customers storing precious metals, and specifically a lot of customers with retirement accounts. And so for us, what we were able to do is we have accounts there for the business. We also have customer accounts there. And so we were able to provide statements of these accounts when we were in our interviews with the consular officer and when we were prepping our package. But the key thing is also is when you attain service providers like this is making sure you have contracts and good standing. So we made sure we had our contract with Dillon Gage signed there. We had our contracts for storage. We had our contracts with IRA custodians that we provide services to, because these are important for a consular officer to say, hey, these people have legitimate business. They provide services to clients already. And it goes to help your case, right? And showing that you have a real operation.
Exactly. So a wealth of documentation just to show that your investment is enough for that marginality.
Yeah. At the end of the day, I think one thing I sometimes would forget in the process, but you have to constantly remind yourself, you have to assume that the person reading your package or the consular officer has absolutely no idea about your industry or your business.
That is such a true point, Greg. And we have to have this premise for almost everything that we do. But here's another issue. You know your business very well. And you, I presume, have been working in this business for some years in Canada. What about someone who is coming to the US, wants to come in on an E2, but wants to start a brand new business?
Yeah, no matter what, whether you have an operating business with a significant knowledge or you're starting a new business, it's all going to go back to that business plan that you provide in your package.
Right.
So for me, having a clear focus in your business plan, as well as financial projections and realistic financial projections, as well as a clear plan of where your business is going to be, how you're going to make your money, and what your plan is to expand. Because one of the major concerns that they're going to have when they're approving or denying this visa is, are you going to have a significant impact on the economy? You can do that in two ways. And one thing, if you're going to get this visa, you need to decide if you're going to do both or which one you're going to do. And you have to make your case for that is, you can do it by either paying a lot of taxes in the sense that your business could be you and a couple employees, but you grow a lot of revenue and you pay taxes and you contribute to the economy that way.
Right.
Or you could have an aggressive plan to hire significant amount of people and contribute to the economy by stimulating employment. You can do both. But I think one thing, aside from having that clear business plan, and this goes to be a part of that, is you need to make it clear to them that you're going to have a significant impact on the economy. And you need to make it clear as to how you plan to do that and how you plan to sustain that. And I think as long as those things are clear, it's not going to be too hard of a time proving your case, right?
Yeah, Greg, you mentioned, impact or significant impact or at least a measurable impact on the U.S. economy. But Mona, isn't that more of a requirement for an EB-5 visa vice just an E-2? Aren't adjudicators for E-2 just saying, hey, are you investing enough to run this business, not so much the impact to the U.S.?
Well, it is changing, Mark, and we have seen an emphasis more on the overall impact. And I think really where we're coming from is the fact that EB-5 has become so popular, and a lot of people who do E-2 do jump from E-2 to EB-5 at a later stage. So I feel as though USCIS and consular officers are more in tune with looking at an economic impact. And Greg, you'll know that I know you own your business 100%, but for E2, you could also have a 50-50% ownership structure, and you could bring in somebody with a lot of equity or someone else with more standing in the US. Have you considered that?
I'm glad you mentioned that because, yeah, Believe it or not, I actually do. The way this E2 worked, it is 50-50 with an aspect of negative control. As you know, that precedent was sent a few years back. But it's 50-50 in the way we did it. And we did it that way specifically because it was the goal of the family. So it's both my father and I, 50-50 type of thing. And it was the best thing for our family to do, aside from the fact that we're a good team and we know how to run the business well together, because it's not our first venture together. I think that's one thing that's unique about the E2, where if you're confident in a partnership or you need some sort of extra investment into the business and you have someone you can trust, it's a great way to do it.
It is. But at the same time, is it always okay to split the managerial and operational duties? Because that could be problematic, especially if your partner, it doesn't live there or really is not focused in the same way.
Well, I think for me, one thing that's been really important is having clear, defined roles. And I know that's easy to say, but you bring it up. And the issues in most partnerships and things that fall apart is because you don't have clear defined roles and duties, and one partner feels like they're doing more necessarily than another. And so when we decided we were going to file as a partnership, one thing that we were very clear about was, hey, we need to define exactly what our responsibilities are, not just for ourselves in the partnership, but this is also something we're going to have to prove to USCIS and to a consular officer that we're both required and that we both are making an impact on the business, not just for the visa, but in any partnership, right? It's like that, and don't want to be corny here, but you're only as strong as your weakest link, so to speak. And so if you're not both pulling your weight and you don't both have those clear defined roles, it's only going to harm you rather than help you.
Yeah, that's right, Greg. Well, a lot of people do E2s to avoid taxes rather than go into becoming a permanent resident. Are you filing taxes both in Canada still and in the US, or are you in the US long enough for you to just do US taxes?
This year will be the first year where I'm in the US long enough to just file US taxes. Unfortunately, as we all know, this week was tax deadline, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, as much as I wish I didn't have to file Canadian taxes, I did have to for 2023. But I'm quite excited that for 2024, I will spend enough time in the United States to be able to file down here.
And do you prefer filing taxes in the US as opposed to Canada?
Personally, yeah. I think the tax code here, it is written in a way to reward investment and business ownership, which is something in Canada that we don't have. The more you're able to invest, the more you're able to continue to reinvest, the more taxes you can defer. It's not, obviously you have write-offs, but most of the taxes is deferred. And that's something in Canada, no matter what you're doing, the government's taking their money, right? There's certain things you can do to write it down a little bit, but you have more leeway, I would say, in the US for sure, especially as a business owner.
But Greg, as a caveat to that, the US does require you to file taxes on worldwide income. So if you still had the operating business or other assets in Canada, you would be paying taxes on that.
For sure. Yeah, you definitely would. And, you know, one thing you have to keep in mind is that no matter where you're paying taxes, these government services want to make sure that they're getting what's owed to them.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
For me, when we look at just overall tax rates and we look at the way that the IRS collects their taxes, especially towards business owners and people that own assets, it's much more favorable.
Greg, in your opinion, somebody who wants to really avoid taxes, you know, there's a lot of people who approach us who want to avoid taxes and do an E2. Is this a visa that you would actually recommend?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, especially speaking in a public forum, we want to be very careful what we're saying, tax avoidance versus tax evasion.
We mean, you know, tax optimization is what she really means.
yeah, tax optimization. I think when we look at the E2, and for me, specifically talking about Canada versus US, the E2 is the best option I had in terms of growing a business, being somewhere that, like a state like Florida, for instance, where there's no state income tax and you're just subject to federal. When we look at the ability with different tax codes to defer, write off, and minimize your taxable burden, there's nowhere else I would go. I would say that. And I think the E2 was the best option as a business owner to do if you don't necessarily either meet the employment requirements or the capital investment for an EB-5.
You know, it goes back to, again, having a good team. If you have the right CPA and bookkeeper and everything, it makes all the difference.
Yeah. And I just want to touch on that, Mona, because I think that's the most important thing. If I could say anything to anyone who's looking to file an E2, the best thing you can do is establish as early on as possible a good core team of people in the United States where you plan to have your investment. And that means a good CPA, a good lawyer, you want to have a good relationship with a banker. And if you have that, not only are you better able to function as a business, but you're able to prove or make the case to the consular officer that, hey, I not only have a good plan for this business and I've made this investment, but I have the right people around me and a team to help me execute my plan.
Greg, I really do agree with you because we do come across a lot of people who really want to continue with service providers in their home country, and that isn't the most efficient. But the other difficult point here is, how do you find the right team? Any advice? Any tips?
That's a great question. I think for me, and I'll just speak to my journey a little bit, I am a big fan of referral from experience or referrals from word of mouth. And so my first move when I incorporated and opened the bank accounts was I had my banker at Chase Bank give me a list of local CPAs that local businesses used. There was four people on the list, and I interviewed, for instance, those four people and was able to establish my CPA through that referral. My lawyer was actually someone as well that I met through the bank, because one day I was in line at the bank and I found a lady from the UK named Sarah who had obtained a green card, and she has referred everyone to this law firm. So
I'm going to go and hang out in the bank now.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, so, right?
I mention it as my big philosophy is with any of your service providers, yeah, the more you get to know them and let them get to know you, the more you're able to show face so that they know you're a real person. The more of these, not only referrals you're able to obtain, but also the more they're willing to help you through circumstances like this. Because keep in mind, I mean, you're compiling a lot of records and a lot of data to put forward in this package. So you need some of these people to be in your corner.
Wow. You know, Mark, this is just invaluable advice for the new investor or for a new person coming in. These aren't the issues that we normally would even think about. And I'm so grateful to you, Greg, for bringing this up.
Yeah. And if I could say anything to anyone, it's keep in mind, these are, especially like you mentioned, people that want to maintain their relationships with their service providers in their home country. No one's saying you can't use these people anymore, especially for those assets you still hold in that home country. But if you're willing to move to another country to establish a business, the best thing you can do is have local service providers that are experts in the tax laws and the different legalities in this country. You want to make sure that you're doing everything right, especially when going through USCIS.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. And Mona, it sounds like a common theme, whether people are coming here to the U.S. or people are investing abroad for various citizenship programs. Greg, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for being with us today on Global Investment Voice. Do you want to get the most out of global migration and citizenship opportunities? Then head on over to our website at globalinvestmentvoice.com. From there, you can easily search and stream from hundreds of podcast episodes, as well as stay current with the latest migration news and investment opportunities by joining our insider newsletter. The topics presented in this podcast are informational in nature only and are not to be taken as specific legal, financial, or investment advice. Mona, Rebecca, and their legal staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com or by calling their New York office at 212-233-7473.